Chapter 9. It's Greek to me. In these last three chapters, we've talked about three sorts of myth: Shakespearean, biblical, and folk/fairy tale. The connection of religion and myth sometimes causes trouble in class when someone takes myth to mean untrue and finds it hard to unite that meaning with deeply held religious beliefs. That's not what I mean by myth, though. Rather, what I'm suggesting is the shaping and sustaining power of story and symbol. Whether one believes that the story of Adam and Eve is true, literally or figuratively, matters, but not in this context. Here, in this activity of reading and understanding literature, we're chiefly concerned with how that story functions as material for literary creators, the way in which it can inform a story or poem, and how it is perceived by the reader. All three of these mythologies work as sources of material, of correspondences, of depth for the modern writer. And every writer is modern. Even John Dryden was not archaic when he was writing. And provided they're recognizable to the reader, they enrich and enhance the reading experience. Of the three, biblical myth probably covers the greatest range of human situations, encompassing all ages of life, including the next life, all relationships, whether personal or governmental, and all phases of the individual's experience, physical, sexual, psychological, spiritual. Still, both the worlds of Shakespeare and of fairy and folk tales provide fairly complete coverage as well. What we mean in speaking of myth in general is story, the ability of story to explain ourselves to ourselves, in ways that physics, philosophy, mathematics, chemistry, all very highly useful and informative in their own right, can't. That explanation takes the shape of stories that are deeply ingrained in our group memory, that shape our culture and are in turn shaped by it, that constitute a way of seeing by which we read the world and, ultimately, ourselves. Let's say it this way. Myth is a body of story that matters. Every community has its own body of story that matters. 19th century composer Richard Wagner went back to the Germanic myths for the material for his operas, and whether the results are good or bad in either historic or musical terms, the impulse to work with his tribal myths is completely understandable. The late 20th century witnessed a great surge of Native American writing, much of which went back to tribal myth for material, for imagery, for theme, as in the case of Leslie Marmon Silko's Yellow Woman, Louise Erdrich's Cashpaw Nanapush novels, and Gerald Visner's peculiar Bearheart, The Airship Chronicles. When Toni Morrison introduces human flight into Song of Solomon, many readers, white readers especially, take her to be referring to Icarus, whereas what she really has in mind, she has said, is the myth of the flying Africans, a story that matters to her community, her tribe. On one level, there's not much difference between Silko's project and Wagner's. He, too, is simply going back to the myths of his tribe. We sometimes forget that people in an age of top hats and stiff collars had tribes, but we do so at our peril. In all these cases, what the artist is doing is reaching back for stories that matter to him and his community, for myth. In European and Euro-American cultures, of course, there's another source of myth. Let me rephrase that. Myth. When most of us think myth, we mean the northern shores of the Mediterranean between 2,000 and 3,000 years ago. We mean Greece and Rome. Greek and Roman myth is so much a part of the fabric of our consciousness, of our unconscious, really, that we scarcely notice. You doubt me? In the town where I live, the college teams are known as the Spartans. Our high school, the Trojans. In my state, we have a Troy, one of whose high schools is Athens, and they say there are no comedians in education, an Ithaca, a Sparta, a Romulus, a Remus, and a Rome. These communities are scattered around the state and date from different periods of settlement. Now, if a town in the center of Michigan, a fair distance from anything that can be called Aegean or Ionian, although it's not very far from the town of Ionia, can be named Ithaca, It suggests that Greek myth has had pretty good staying power. Let's go back to Toni Morrison for a moment. I'm always slightly amazed that Icarus gets all the ink. It was his father, Daedalus, who crafted the wings, who knew how to get off Crete and safely reach the mainland, and who, in fact, flew to safety. Icarus, the kid, the daredevil, failed to follow his father's advice and plunged to his death. His fall remains a source of enduring fascination for us and for our literature and art. In it, we see so much. The parental attempt to save the child and the grief at having failed. The cure that proves as deadly as the ailment. The youthful exuberance that leads to self-destruction. The clash between sober adult wisdom and adolescent recklessness and, of course, the terror involved in that headlong descent into the sea. Absolutely none of this has anything to do with Morrison and her flying Africans, so it's little wonder that she's a bit mystified by this response of her readers. But it's a story and a pattern that is so deeply burrowed into our consciousness that readers may almost automatically consider it whenever flying or falling is invoked. Clearly, it doesn't fit the situation in Song of Solomon, but it does apply in other works. In 1558, Peter Bruegel painted a wonderful picture, Landscape with Fall of Icarus. In the foreground, we see a plowman and his ox, just beyond him, a shepherd and his flock, and at sea, a merchant ship sailing placidly along. This is a scene of utter ordinariness and tranquility. Only in the lower right corner of the painting is there anything even remotely suggestive of trouble, a pair of legs askew as they disappear into the water. That's our boy. He really doesn't have much of a presence in the frame, but his presence makes all the difference. Without the pathos of the doomed boy, we have a picture of farming and merchant shipping with no narrative or thematic power. I teach, with some regularity, two great poems based on that painting, W.H. Auden's Musée des Beaux-Arts, 1940, and William Carlos Williams' Landscape with Fall of Icarus, 1962. They're wonderful poems, very different from each other in tone, style, and form, but in essential agreement about how the world goes on even in the face of our private tragedies. Each artist alters what he finds in the painting. Bruegel introduces the plowman and the ship, neither of which appears in the version that comes to us from the Greeks, and Williams and Auden find, in their turn, slightly different elements to emphasize in the painting. Williams' poem stresses the pictorial elements of the painting, trying to capture the scene while sneaking in the thematic elements. Even his arrangement of the poem on the page, narrow and highly vertical, recalls the body plummeting from the sky. Auden's poem, on the other hand, is a meditation on the private nature of suffering and the way in which the larger world takes no interest in our private disasters. It is astonishing and pleasing to discover that the painting can occasion these two very different responses. Beyond them, readers find their own messages in all this. As someone who was a teenager in the 60s, I am reminded by the fate of Icarus of all those kids who bought muscle cars with names like GTO and 442 and Charger and Barracuda. All the driver education and solid parental advice in the world can't overcome the allure of that kind of power. And sadly, in too many cases, those young drivers shared the fate of Icarus. My students, somewhat younger than I am, will inevitably draw other parallels. Still, it all goes back to the myth, the boy, the wings, the unscheduled dive. So that's one way classical myth can work. Overt subject matter for poems and paintings and operas and novels. What else can myth do? Here's a thought. Let's say you wanted to write an epic poem about a community of poor fishermen in the Caribbean. If this was a place you came from, and you knew these people like you know your own family, you'd want to depict the jealousies and resentments and adventure and danger, as well as capturing their dignity and their life in a way that conveys all that has escaped the notice of tourists and white property owners. You could, I suppose, try being really, really earnest, portraying the characters as very serious and sober, making them noble by virtue of their goodness. But I bet that wouldn't work. What you'd wind up with instead would probably be very stiff and artificial, and artificiality is never noble. Besides, these folks aren't saints. They make a lot of mistakes. They're petty, envious, lustful, occasionally greedy, as well as courageous, elegant, powerful, knowledgeable, profound. And you want noble, after all. Not Tonto. There's no Lone Ranger here. Alternatively, you might try grafting their story onto some older story of rivalry and violence. A story where even the victor is ultimately doomed. A story where, despite occasional personal shortcomings, the characters have an unmistakable nobility. You could give your characters names like Helen, Philoctetes, Hector, and Achilles. At least, that's what Nobel Prize winner Derek Walcott does in his Omeros, 1990. Those names are drawn, of course, from the Iliad, although Walcott uses elements, parallels, persons, and situations of both it and the Odyssey in his epic. The question we will inevitably ask is, why? Why should someone in the late 20th century draw on a story that was passed along orally from the 12th through the 8th century BC and not written down until maybe 200 or 300 years later? Why should someone try to compare modern fishermen with these legendary heroes, many of whom were descended from gods? Well, for starters, Homer's legendary heroes were farmers and fishermen. Besides, aren't we all descended from gods? Walcott reminds us by this parallel of the potential for greatness that resides in all of us, no matter how humble our worldly circumstances. That's one answer. The other is that the situations match up more closely than we might expect. The plot of the Iliad is not particularly divine or global. Those who have never read it assume mistakenly that it is the story of the Trojan War. It is not. It is the story of a single, rather lengthy action, the wrath of Achilles. Achilles becomes angry with his leader, Agamemnon, withdraws his support from the Greeks, only rejoining the battle when the consequences of his action have destroyed his best friend, Patroclus. At this point, he turns his wrath against the Trojans and in particular their greatest hero, Hector, whom he eventually kills. His reason for such anger? Agamemnon has taken his war prize. Trivial? It gets worse. The prize is a woman. Agamemnon, forced by divine order and by public sentiment to return his concubine to her father, retaliates against the person who most publicly sided against him, Achilles, by taking his concubine, Briseis. Is that petty enough? Is that noble? No Helen, no judgment of Paris, no Trojan horse. At its core, it's the story of a man who goes berserk because his stolen war bride is confiscated, acted out against a background of wholesale slaughter, the whole of which is taking place because another man, Menelaus, brother of Agamemnon, has had his wife stolen by Paris, half-brother of Hector. That's how Hector winds up having to carry the hopes for salvation of all Troy on his shoulders. And yet somehow, through the centuries, this story dominated by the theft of two women has come to epitomize ideals of heroism and loyalty, sacrifice and loss. Hector is more stubbornly heroic in his doomed enterprise than anyone you've ever seen. Achilles' grief at the loss of his beloved friend is truly heartbreaking. The big duels between Hector and Ajax, between Diomedes and Paris, between Hector and Patroclus, between Hector and Achilles are genuinely exciting and suspenseful. Their outcomes, sources of grand celebration and dismay. No wonder so many modern writers have often borrowed from and emulated Homer. And when did that begin? Almost immediately. Virgil, who died in 19 BC, patterned his Aeneas on the Homeric heroes. If Achilles did it, or Odysseus went there, so does Aeneas. Why? It's what heroes do. Aeneas goes to the underworld. Why? Odysseus went there. He kills a giant from the enemy camp in a final climactic battle. Why? Achilles did. And so on. The whole thing is less derivative than it sounds, and not without humor and irony. Aeneas and his followers are survivors of Troy. So here we have this Trojan hero acting out the pattern set down by his enemies. Moreover, when these Trojans sail past Ithaca, home to Odysseus, they jeer and curse the agent of their destruction. On the whole, though, Virgil has him undertake these actions because Homer had already defined what it means to be a hero. Back to Walcott. Almost exactly 2,000 years after Virgil, Walcott has his heroes perform actions that we can recognize as symbolic reenactments of those in Homer. Sometimes it's a bit of a stretch, since we can't have a lot of battlefield duels out in the fishing boats. Nor can we call his Helen the face that launched 1,000 dinghies. Lacks grandeur, that phrase. What he can do, though, is place them in situations where their nobility and their courage are put to the test, while reminding us that they are acting out some of the most basic, most primal patterns known to humans, exactly as Homer did all those centuries before. The need to protect one's family, Hector. The need to maintain one's dignity, Achilles. The determination to remain faithful and to have faith, Penelope. The struggle to return home, Odysseus. Homer gives us four great struggles of the human being, with nature, with the divine, with other humans, and with ourselves. What is there, after all, against which we need to prove ourselves but those four things? In our modern world, of course, parallels may be ironized, that is, turned on their head for purposes of irony. How many of us would see the comedy of three escaped convicts as parallel to the wanderings of Odysseus? Still, that's what the brothers Joel and Ethan Coen give us in their 2000 film, O Brother, Where Art Thou? It's about trying to get home, isn't it? Or this, the most famous example. A single day in Dublin in 1904, on which a young man decides on his future and an older man wanders the city, eventually returning home to his wife in the small hours of the next morning. The book has only one overt clue that this all might have something to do with Homer. Its one-word title, Ulysses, 1922. As we now know, James Joyce envisioned every one of the 18 episodes of the novel as a parallel to some incident or situation in the Odyssey. There's an episode in a newspaper office, for instance, which parallels Odysseus's visit to Aeolus, the god of the winds, but the parallel may seem pretty tenuous. To be sure, newspaper men are a windy group, and there are a lot of rhetorical flourishes in the episode, to say nothing of the fact that a gust of wind does zip through at one point. Still, we can see it as resembling the Homeric original, only if we understand that resemblance in terms of a funhouse mirror, full of distortion and goofy correspondences. If we understand it, in other words, as an ironic parallel. The fact that it's ironic makes the parallel, and the Aeolus episode, such fun. Joyce is less interested than Walcott in investing his characters with classical nobility, although finally they do take on something of that quality. After watching poor old Leopold Bloom stroll around Dublin all day and half the night, running into no end of trouble and recalling great heartbreak in his life, we may well come to feel he is noble in his own way. His nobility, however, is not that of Odysseus. Greek and Roman myth, of course, is more than Homer. The transformations of Ovid's Metamorphoses show up in all sorts of later works, not least in Franz Kafka's story of a man who wakes up one morning to find he's changed into an enormous beetle. He called it the Metamorphosis. Indiana Jones may look like pure Hollywood, but the intrepid searcher after fabulous treasure goes back to Apollonius and the Argonautica, the story of Jason and the Argonauts. Something a bit homier? Sophocles' plays of Oedipus and his doomed clan show up over and over again in all sorts of variations. There is, in fact, no form of dysfunctional family or no personal disintegration of character for which there is not a Greek or Roman model. Not for nothing do the names of Greek tragic characters figure in Freud's theories. The wronged woman gone violent in her grief and madness? Would you like Aeneas and Dido, or Jason and Medea? And as in every good early religion, they had an explanation for natural phenomena, from the change of seasons, Demeter and Persephone and Hades, to why the nightingale sounds the way it does, Philomena and Tereus. Happily for us, most of it got written down, often in several versions, so that we have access to this wonderful body of story. And because writers and readers share knowledge of a big portion of this body of story, this mythology, when writers use it, we readers recognize it, sometimes to its full extent, sometimes only dimly or only because we know the Looney Tunes version. That recognition makes our experience of literature richer, deeper, more meaningful, so that our own modern stories also matter, also share in the power of myth. Oh, did I forget to say that title of Walcott's Omeros? In the local dialect, it means Homer. Naturally. Chapter 10. It's More Than Just Rain or Snow. It was a dark and stormy night. What, you've heard that one? Right, Snoopy. And Charles Schulz had Snoopy write it because it was a cliché, and had been one for a very long time, way back when your favorite beagle decided to become a writer. This one we know. Edward Bulwer Lytton, celebrated Victorian popular novelist, actually did write It Was a Dark and Stormy Night. In fact, he began a novel with it, and not a very good novel either. And now you know everything you need to know about dark and stormy nights, except for one thing. Why? You wondered that too, didn't you? Why would a writer want the wind howling and the rain bucketing down? Want the manor house or the cottage or the weary traveler lashed and battered? You may say that every story needs a setting and that weather is part of the setting. That is true, by the way, but it isn't the whole deal. There's much more to it. Here's what I think. Weather is never just weather. It's never just rain. And that goes for snow, sun, warmth, cold, and probably sleet, although the incidence of sleet in my reading is too rare to generalize. So what's special about rain? Ever since we crawled up on the land, the water, it seems to us, has been trying to reclaim us. Periodically, floods come and try to drag us back into the water, pulling down our improvements while they're at it. You know the story of Noah. Lots of rain, major flood. Ark, cubits, dove, olive branch, rainbow. I think that biblical tale must have been the most comforting of all to ancient humans. The rainbow, by which God told Noah that no matter how angry he got, he would never try to wipe us out completely, must have come as a great relief. We in the Judeo-Christian Islamic world have a fair chunk of mythology invested in rain and its most major byproduct. Clearly, rain features in other mythologies as well, but for now, let this be our cornerstone. Drowning is one of our deepest fears, being land creatures after all, and the drowning of everything and everybody just magnifies that fear. Rain prompts ancestral memories of the most profound sort, so water in great volume speaks to us at a very basic level of our being. And at times, Noah is what it signifies. Certainly when D.H. Lawrence has the flood go crashing through the family homestead in The Virgin and the Gypsy, 1930, he's thinking of Noah's flood, the big eraser that destroys but also allows a brand new start. Rain, though, can do a lot more. That dark and stormy evening, and I suspect that before general illumination by streetlight and neon, all stormy evenings were pretty darn dark, has worlds of atmosphere and mood. Thomas Hardy, a considerably better Victorian writer than Edward B.L., has a delightful story called The Three Strangers, 1883, in which a condemned man, escaped, a hangman, and the escapee's brother all converge on a shepherd's house during a christening party. The hangman doesn't recognize his quarry, nor do the members of the party, but the brother does, and runs away, leading to a manhunt and general hilarity, all of which is taking place on a, well, dark and stormy night. Hardy doesn't call it that, but he has great fun describing in his ironic and detached tone the rain lashing down on hapless wayfarers, forcing them to seek shelter where they can. Hence the appearance of our three gentlemen callers. Now, the Bible is never very far from Hardy's thoughts, but I dare say he has no idea of Noah when he's writing about this storm. So why does he bring rain into it? First of all, as a plot device, the rain forces these men together in very uncomfortable, for the condemned man and the brother, circumstances. I occasionally disparage plot, but we should never discount its importance in authorial decision-making. Second, atmospherics. Rain can be more mysterious, murkier, more isolating than most other weather conditions. Fog is good too, of course. Then there is the misery factor. Given the choice between alternatives, Hardy will always go for making his characters more miserable, and rain has a higher wretchedness quotient than almost any other element of our environment. With a little rain and a bit of wind, you can die of hypothermia on the 4th of July. Needless to say, Hardy loves rain. And finally, there is the democratic element. Rain falls on the just and the unjust alike. Condemned man and hangman are thrown into a bond of sorts because rain has forced each of them to seek shelter. Rain can do other things as well, but these are the reasons, it seems to me, that Hardy has chosen a nice, malicious rainstorm for his story. What other things? For one, it's clean. One of the paradoxes of rain is how clean it is coming down and how much mud it can make when it lands. So if you want a character to be cleansed, symbolically, let him walk through the rain to get somewhere. He can be quite transformed when he gets there. He may also have a cold, but that's another matter. He can be less angry, less confused, more repentant, whatever you want. The stain that was upon him, figuratively, can be removed. On the other hand, if he falls down, he'll be covered in mud and therefore more stained than before. You can have it either way or both ways if you're really good. The problem with cleansing, though, is the problem with wishes. You have to be careful what you wish for, for that matter, what you want cleansed. Sometimes it backfires. In Song of Solomon, Toni Morrison gives her poor, jilted lover, Hagar, an encounter with cleansing rain. Having been thrown over by her longtime lover and cousin, it's very awkward, Milkman, for a more presentable love interest, with looks and especially hair nearer the white ideal, Hagar spends a desperate day buying clothes and accessories, visiting hair and nail salons, and generally turning herself into a simulacrum of the woman she thinks Milkman wants. After spending all her money and psychic energy in this mad plunge into a fantasy image, she is caught out in a rainstorm that ruins her clothes, her packages, and her coiffure. She is left with her despised, kinky, black hair and her self-loathing. Rather than washing away some taint, the rain cleanses her of illusions and the false ideal of beauty. The experience, of course, destroys her, and she soon dies of a broken heart and rain. So much for the salutary effects of cleansing rains. On the other hand, rain is also restorative. This is chiefly because of its association with spring, but Noah once again comes into play here. Rain can bring the world back to life, to new growth, to the return of the green world. Of course, novelists, being what they are, they generally use this function ironically. In the ending of A Farewell to Arms, 1929, Hemingway, having killed off Frederick Henry's lover during childbirth, sends the grieving protagonist out of the hospital into, you guessed it, rain. It might be ironic enough to die during childbirth, which is also associated with spring. But the rain, which we might properly expect to be life-giving, further heightens the irony. It's hard to get irony too high for Hemingway. So too with Joyce's The Dead. Near the ending, Greta Conroy tells her husband about the great love of her life, the long-dead Michael Fury, a consumptive boy who stood outside her window in the rain and died a week later. One might argue that this is simply verisimilitude. If the story is set in the west of Ireland, it almost requires rain. No doubt there is justice in this view. But at the same time, Joyce knowingly plays off our expectations of rain as an agent of new life and restoration because he also knows that we have another, less literary set of associations for rain, the source of chills, colds, pneumonia, death. These come together and clash intriguingly in the image of the boy dying for love. Youth, death, replenishment, desolation, they're all rattling around in the figure of poor Michael Fury in the rain. Joyce likes his irony about as high as Hemingway's. Rain is the principal element of spring. April showers do, in fact, bring May flowers. Spring is the season, not only of renewal, but of hope, of new awakenings. Now, if you're a modernist poet, and therefore given to irony, notice that I've not yet alluded to modernism without having recourse to irony. You might stand that association on its head and begin your poem with a line like, "April is the cruelest month," which is exactly what T.S. Eliot does in The Wasteland. In that poem, he plays off our cultural expectations of spring and rain and fertility. Better, readers don't even have to ask if he is doing it deliberately, since he very thoughtfully provides notes telling us that he's being deliberate. He even tells us which study of romance he's using, Jesse L. Weston's From Ritual to Romance, 1920. What Weston talks about in her book is the Fisher King mythology, of which the Arthurian legends are just one part. The central figure in this set of myths, the Fisher King figure, represents the hero as fixer. Something in society is broken, perhaps beyond repair, but a hero emerges to put things right. Since natural and agricultural fertility is so important to our ability to feed and sustain ourselves, much of the material Weston deals with has to do with wastelands and the attempts to restore lost fertility. Needless to say, rain figures prominently. Following Weston's lead, Eliot emphasizes the absence of rain from the beginning of his poem. On the other hand, water generally is a mixed medium in his text, the River Thames being polluted and a scene of corruption, complete with a slimy-bellied rat on the bank. Moreover, the rain never quite arrives. We're told at the end that rain is coming, but that's not the same as rain actually hitting the ground around us. So then, it isn't quite happening, and we can't be sure of its effect when it does fall, if it does, but its absence occupies a major space in the poem. Rain mixes with sun to create rainbows. We mentioned this one before, but it merits our consideration. While we may have minor associations with pots of gold and leprechauns, the main function of the image of the rainbow is to symbolize divine promise. Peace between heaven and earth. God promised Noah with the rainbow never again to flood the whole earth. No writer in the West can employ a rainbow without being aware of its signifying aspect, its biblical function. Lawrence called one of his best novels The Rainbow, 1916. It has, as you would guess, a certain amount of flood imagery, along with all the associations that imagery conveys. When you read about a rainbow, as in Elizabeth Bishop's poem, The Fish, 1947, where she closes with the sudden vision that everything was rainbow, 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 you just know there's some element of this divine pact between human, nature, and God. Of course, she lets the fish go. In fact, of any interpretation a reader will ever come up with, the rainbow probably forms the most obvious set of connections. Rainbows are sufficiently uncommon and gaudy that they're pretty hard to miss, and their meaning runs as deep in our culture as anything you care to name. Once you can figure out rainbows, you can do rain and all the rest. Fog, for instance. It almost always signals some sort of confusion. Dickens uses a miasma, a literal and figurative fog, for the Court of Chancery, the English version of American probate court, where estates are sorted out and wills contested, in Bleak House, 1853. Henry Green uses a heavy fog to gridlock London and strand his wealthy young travelers in a hotel in Party Going, 1939. In each case, the fog is mental and ethical as well as physical. In almost any case I can think of, authors use fog to suggest that people can't see clearly, that matters under consideration are murky. And snow? It can mean as much as rain. Different things, though. Snow is clean, stark, severe, warm as an insulating blanket, paradoxically, inhospitable, inviting, playful, suffocating, filthy, after enough time has elapsed. You can do just about anything you want with snow. In The Peterson Kid, 1968, William H. Gass has death arrive on the heels of a monster blizzard. In his poem The Snowman, 1923, Wallace Stevens uses snow to indicate inhuman abstract thought, particularly thought concerned with nothingness, nothing that is not there and the nothing that is, as he puts it. Very chilling image, that. And in The Dead, Joyce takes his hero to a moment of discovery. Gabriel, who sees himself as superior to other people, has undergone an evening in which he is broken down, little by little, until he can look out at the snow, which is general all over Ireland, and suddenly realize that snow, like death, is the great unifier, that it falls in the beautiful closing image upon all the living and the dead. This will all come up again when we talk about seasons. There are many more possibilities for weather, of course, more than we could cover in a whole book. For now, though, one does well to remember, as one starts reading a poem or story, to check the weather. Interlude. Does he mean that? Along about now, you should be asking a question, something like this. You keep saying that the writer is alluding to this obscure work and using that symbol or following some pattern or other that I never heard of, but does he really intend to do that? Can anyone really have all that going on in his head at one time? Now that is an excellent question. I only wish I had an excellent answer. Something pithy and substantive, maybe with a little alliteration. But instead, I have one that's merely short. Yes. The chief deficiency of this answer, aside from its lack of pith, is that it is manifestly untrue, or at least misleading. The real answer, of course, is that no one knows for certain. Oh, for this writer or that one, we can be pretty sure, depending on what they themselves tell us, but in general, we make guesses. Let's look at the easy ones. James Joyce, T.S. Eliot, and what we could call the intentionalists, writers who attempt to control every facet of their creative output and who intend virtually every effect in their works. Many of them are from the modernist period, essentially the era around the two world wars of the 20th century. In an essay called Ulysses, Order and Myth, 1923, Eliot extols the virtues of Joyce's newly published masterpiece and proclaims that, whereas writers of previous generations relied on the narrative method, modern writers can, following Joyce's example, employ the mythic method. Ulysses, as we know from our earlier discussion, is the very long story of a single day in Dublin, June 16, 1904, its structure modeled on Homer's Odyssey, Ulysses being the Latin equivalent of the name of Homer's hero, Odysseus. The structure of the novel utilizes the various episodes of the ancient epic, although, ironically, Odysseus's trip to the underworld, for instance, becomes a trip to the cemetery. His encounter with Circe, an enchantress who turns men into swine, becomes a trip to a notorious brothel by the protagonists. Eliot uses his essay on Joyce to defend implicitly his own masterpiece, The Wasteland, which also builds around ancient myths, in this case, fertility myths associated with the Fisher King. Ezra Pound borrows from Greek, Latin, Chinese, English, Italian, and French poetic traditions in the cantos. D.H. Lawrence writes essays about Egyptian and Mexican myth, Freudian psychoanalysis, issues in the Book of Revelation, and the history of the novel in Europe and America. Do we really believe that novels or poems by any of these writers or their contemporaries, Virginia Woolf, Catherine Mansfield, Ernest Hemingway, and William Faulkner, will be naive? Doesn't seem likely, does it? Faulkner, for instance, in Absalom, Absalom, 1936, makes use of a title from the Bible. Absalom is David's rebellious son who hangs himself, and plot and characters from Greek mythology. The novel is Faulkner's version of Aeschylus's Oresteia, 458 BC, the tragedy of the returning soldiers from Troy and revenge and destruction on a mythic scale. Their Trojan War is the Civil War, of course, and the murder at the gates is of the illegitimate son by his brother, not of the returning husband, Agamemnon, by his faithless wife, Clytemnestra, although she is invoked in the mulatto slave, Clytie. He gives us Orestes, the avenging son pursued by Furies and ultimately consumed in the flames of the family mansion, in Henry Sutpin, and Electra, the daughter consumed by grief and mourning, in his sister Judith. Such Baroque planning and complex execution don't leave much room for naive, spontaneous composition. Okay, so much for the modern writers. But what about earlier periods? Prior to 1900, most poets would have received at least rudimentary elements of a classical education. Latin, some Greek, lots of classical poetry, and Dante and Shakespeare, certainly more than your average reader today. They could count on their readers, moreover, having considerable training in the tradition. One of the surest ways to be successful in theater in the 19th century was to take a touring Shakespeare company through the American West. If folks in their little houses on the prairie could quote the bard, is it likely that their writers accidentally wrote stories that paralleled his? Since proof is nearly impossible, discussions of the writer's intentions are not especially profitable. Instead, let's restrict ourselves to what he did do, and more important, what we readers can discover in his work. What we have to work with is hints and allegations, really evidence, sometimes only a trace, that points to something lying behind the text. It's useful to keep in mind that any aspiring writer is probably also a hungry, aggressive reader as well, and will have absorbed a tremendous amount of literary history and literary culture. By the time she writes her books, she has access to that tradition in ways that need not be conscious. Nevertheless, whatever parts have infiltrated her consciousness are always available to her. Something else that we should bear in mind has to do with speed of composition. The few pages of this chapter have taken you a few minutes to read. They have taken me, I'm sorry to say, days and days to write. No, I haven't been sitting at my computer the whole time. First, I carried the germ around for a while, mulling over how best to approach it. Then I sat down and knocked a few items onto the screen. Then I began fleshing out the argument. Then I got stuck. So I made lunch or baked some bread or helped my kid work on his car, but I carried the problem of this chapter around with me the whole time. I sat down at the keyboard again and started in again, but got distracted and worked on something else. Eventually, I got where we are now. Even assuming equal levels of knowledge about the subject, who probably has had the most ideas? You in 5 minutes of reading, or me in 5 days of stumbling around? All I'm really saying is that we readers sometimes forget how long literary composition can take and how very much lateral thinking can go on in that amount of time. And lateral thinking is what we're really discussing. The way writers can keep their eye on the target, whether it be the plot of the play or the ending of the novel or the argument of the poem, and at the same time bring in a great deal of at least tangentially related material. I used to think it was this great gift literary geniuses have, but I'm not so sure anymore. I sometimes teach a creative writing course, and my aspiring fiction writers frequently bring in biblical parallels classical or Shakespearean allusions, bits of REM songs, fairy tale fragments, anything you can think of. And neither they nor I would claim that anybody in that room is a genius. It's something that starts happening when a reader slash writer and a sheet of paper get locked in a room together. And it's a great deal of what makes reading the work of my students, of recent graduates of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, of Keats and Shelley, interesting and fun. Chapter 11. More Than It's Gonna Hurt You. Concerning Violence. Consider. Sethi is an escaped slave, and her children were all born in slave-owning Kentucky. Their escape to Ohio is like the Israelites' escape from Egypt in Exodus. Except that this time, Pharaoh shows up on the doorstep threatening to drag them back across the Red Sea. So Sethi decides to save her children from slavery by killing them, succeeding with only one of them. Later, when that murdered child, the title character of Toni Morrison's Beloved, makes her ghostly return, she's more than simply the child lost to violence, sacrificed to the revulsion of the escaped slave toward her former state. Instead, she is one of, in the words of the epigraph to the novel, the 60 million and more Africans and African-descended slaves who died in captivity and forced marches on the continent or in the Middle Passage or on the plantations made possible by their captive labor, or in attempts to escape a system that should have been unthinkable. As unthinkable as, for instance, a mother seeing no other means of rescuing her child except infanticide. Beloved is in fact representative of the horrors to which a whole race was subjected. Violence is one of the most personal and even intimate acts between human beings, but it can also be cultural and societal in its implications. It can be symbolic, thematic, biblical, Shakespearean, romantic, allegorical, transcendent. Violence in real life just is. If someone punches you in the nose in a supermarket parking lot, it's simply aggression. It doesn't contain meaning beyond the act itself. Violence in literature, though, while it is literal, is usually also something else. That same punch in the nose may be a metaphor. Robert Frost has a poem, Out, Out, 1916, about a momentary lapse of attention and the terrible act of violence that ensues. A farm boy working with the buzzsaw looks up at the call to dinner, and the saw, which has been full of menace as it snarls and rattles along, seizes the moment, as if it has a mind of its own, to take off the boy's hand. Now, the first thing we have to acknowledge about this masterpiece is that it is absolutely real. Only a person who has been around the ceaseless danger of farm machinery could have written the poem, with all its careful attention to the details of the way death lurks in everyday tasks. If that's all we get from the poem, fine. The poem will in one sense have done its job. Yet Frost is insisting on more in the poem than a cautionary tale of child labor and power tools. The literal violence encodes a broader point about the essentially hostile or at least uncaring relationship we have with the universe. Our lives and deaths, the boy dies of blood loss and shock, are as nothing to the universe, of which the best that can be said is that it is indifferent, though it may be actively interested in our demise. The title of the poem is taken from Macbeth, Out, Out, Brief Candle, suggesting the brevity, not merely of a teenager's life, but of any human existence, particularly in cosmic terms. The smallness and fragility of our lives is met with the cold indifference not only of the distant stars and planets, which we can rightly think of as virtually eternal in contrast to ourselves, but of the more immediate outer world of the farm itself, of the inhumanity of machinery which wounds or kills indiscriminately. This is not John Milton's Lycidas, 1637, not a classical elegy in which all nature weeps. This nature shows not the slightest ripple of interest. Frost uses the violence here, then, to emphasize our status as orphans, parentless, frightened and alone as we face our mortality in a cold and silent universe. Violence is everywhere in literature. Anna Karenina throws herself under the train. Emma Bovary solves her problem with poison. D.H. Lawrence's characters are always engaging in physical violence toward one another. Joyce's Stephen Dedalus is beaten by soldiers. Faulkner's Colonel Sartoris becomes a greater local legend when he guns down two carpetbaggers in the streets of Jefferson. And Wile E. Coyote holds up his little yikes sign before he plunges into the void as his latest gambit to catch the Roadrunner fails. Even writers as noted for the absence of action as Virginia Woolf and Anton Chekhov routinely resort to killing off characters. For all these deaths and maimings to amount to something deeper than the violence of the Roadrunner cartoon, the violence has to have some meaning beyond mere mayhem. Let's think about two categories of violence in literature. The specific injury that authors cause characters to visit on one another or on themselves, and the narrative violence that causes characters harm in general. The first would include the usual range of behavior. Shootings, stabbings, garrottings, drownings, poisonings, bludgeonings, bombings, hit-and-run accidents, starvations, you name it. By the second, authorial violence, I mean the death and suffering authors introduce into their work in the interest of plot advancement or thematic development, and for which they, not their characters, are responsible. Frost's buzzsaw accident would be such an example, as would Little Nell on her deathbed in Dickens' The Old Curiosity Shop, 1841, and the death of Mrs. Ramsey in Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse, 1927. Is it fair to compare them? I mean, do death by consumption or heart disease really fall into the same universe as a stabbing? Sure, different but the same. Different, no guilty party exists in the narrative, unless you count the author, who is present everywhere and nowhere. Same, does it really matter to the dead person? Or this, writers kill off characters for the same set of reasons, make action happen, cause plot complications, end plot complications, put other characters under stress. And that's not enough reason for violence to exist? With some exceptions, the most prominent being mystery novels, figure at least three corpses for a 200-page mystery, sometimes many more. How significant do these deaths feel? Very nearly meaningless. In fact, aside from the necessities of plot, we scarcely notice the deaths in a detective novel. The author goes out of her way, more often than not, to make the victim sufficiently unpleasant that we scarcely regret his passing. And we may even feel a sort of relief. Now, the rest of the novel will be devoted to solving this murder, so clearly it is important on some level. But the death lacks gravitas. There's no weight, no resonance, no sense of something larger at work. What mysteries generally have in common is a lack of density. What they offer in terms of emotional satisfaction, the problem solved, the question answered, the guilty punished, the victim avenged, they lack in weightiness. And I say this as a person who generally loves the genre and who has read hundreds of mysteries. So where does this alleged weight come from? Not alleged, felt. We sense greater weight or depth in works when there is something happening beyond the surface. In mysteries, whatever layering there may be elsewhere, the murders live on the narrative surface. It's in the nature of the genre that since the act itself is buried under layers of misdirection and obfuscation, it cannot support layers of meaning or signification. On the other hand, literary fiction and drama and poetry are chiefly about those other layers. In that fictive universe, violence is symbolic action. If we only understand Beloved on the surface level, Sethi's act of killing her daughter becomes so repugnant that sympathy for her is nearly impossible. If we lived next to her, for instance, one of us would have to move. But her action carries symbolic significance. We understand it not only as the literal action of a single, momentarily deranged woman, but as an action that speaks for the experience of a race at a certain horrific moment in history. as a gesture explained by whip scars on her back that take the form of a tree, as the product of the sort of terrible choice that only characters in our great mythic stories, a Jocasta, a Dido, a Medea, are driven to make. Sethi isn't a mere woman next door, but a mythic creature, one of the great tragic heroines. I suggested earlier that Lawrence's characters manage to commit a phenomenal amount of violence toward each other. Here are just a couple of examples. In Women in Love, Gudrun Brangwen and Gerald Crick meet after each of them has made separate displays of violent will. In front of the Brangwen sisters, Gerald holds a terrified mare at a grade crossing, spurring her until her flanks bleed. Ursula is outraged and indignant. But Gudrun is so caught up in this display of masculine power, and the language Lawrence uses is very much that of a rape, that she swoons. He later sees her engaging in eurythmics, a pre-Great War version of disco, in front of some highly dangerous Highland cattle. When Gerald stops her to explain the peril she has created for herself, she slaps him hard. This is, mind, their very first meeting. So he says, more or less, "I see you've struck the first blow." Her response? "And I shall strike the last." Very tender. Their relationship pretty much follows from that initial note, with violent clashes of will and ego, violent sex, needy and pathetic visitations, and eventually, hatred and resentment. Technically, I suppose, she's right, since she does strike the last blow. The last time we see them, though, her eyes are bulging out as he strangles her until suddenly he stops, overcome by revulsion, and skis off to his own death in the highest reaches of the Alps. Too weird? Want the other example? In his exquisite novella, The Fox, Lawrence creates one of the oddest triangles in literature. Banford and March are two women running a farm. And the only reason their relationship stops short of being openly lesbian must be because of censorship concerns, Lawrence already having had quite enough works banned by that time. Into this curious menage, a young soldier, Henry Grenfell, wanders, and as he works on the farm, a relationship develops between him and March. When the difficulties of a three-way set of competing interests become insurmountable, Henry chops down a tree which twists, falls, and crushes poor, difficult Banford. Problem solved. Of course, the death gives rise to issues which could scuttle the newly freed relationship, but who can worry about such details? Lawrence, being Lawrence, uses these violent episodes in heavily symbolic ways. His clashes between Gerald and Gudrun, for instance, have as much to do with deficiencies in the capitalist social system and modern values as with personality shortcomings of the participants. Gerald is both an individual and someone corrupted by the values of industry. Lawrence identifies him as a captain of industry, while Gudrun loses much of her initial humanism through association with the corrupt sort of modern artists. And the murder by tree in The Fox isn't about interpersonal hostility, although that antipathy is present in the story. Rather, Banford's demise figures the sexual tensions and gender role confusion of modern society as Lawrence sees it, a world in which the essential qualities of men and women have been lost in the demands of technology and the excessive emphasis on intellect over instinct. We know that these tensions exist, because while Banford, Jill, and March, Ellen or Nellie, sometimes call each other by their Christian names, the text insists on their surnames without using Miss, thereby emphasizing their masculine tendencies, while Henry is simply Henry or the young man. Only by radically changing the interpersonal sexual dynamic can something like Laurentian order be restored. There is also the mythic dimension of this violence. Gerald in Women in Love is repeatedly described as a young god, tall and fair and beautiful, while Gudrun is named for a minor Norse goddess. Their clash, then, automatically follows mythic patterns. Similarly, the young soldier comes striding onto the makeshift farm as a fertility god, fairly screaming virility. Lawrence shared with many of his contemporaries a fascination with ancient myths, particularly those of the wasteland and various fertility cults. For fertility to be restored to the little wasteland of the failing farm, the potent male and the fertile female must be paired off, and any blocking element, including any females with competing romantic interests, must be sacrificed. William Faulkner's violence emanates from a slightly different wellspring, yet the results are not entirely different. I know of creative writing teachers who feel Faulkner is the single greatest danger to budding fiction writers. So alluring is his penchant for violence that the imitation Faulknerian story will have a rape, 3 cases of incest, a stabbing, 2 shootings, and a suicide by drowning, all in 2,000 words. And indeed, there is a great deal of violence of all sorts in his fictional Yaknapatawpha County. In the story Barn Burning, 1939, young Sarty Snopes watches as his father, a serial arsonist, hires out to a wealthy plantation owner, Major Despain, only to attempt to burn the major's barn in a fit of class resentment. When Sarty, whose full name is Colonel Sartorus Snopes, attempts to intercede, Major Despain rides down Ab, the father, and Sardi's elder brother, and the last we hear of them is a series of shots from the major's pistol, leaving Sarty sobbing in the dust. The arson and the shootings here are, of course, literal and need to be understood in that light before we go looking for any further significance. But with Faulkner, the violence is also historically conditioned. Class warfare, racism, and the inheritance of slavery. At one point, Ab says that slave sweat must not have made the Despain mansion white enough and that therefore white sweat, his, is evidently called for. Impotent rage at having lost the Civil War all figure in the violence of a Faulkner story. In Go Down Moses, 1942, Ike McCaslin discovers while reading through plantation ledgers that his grandfather had sired a daughter by one of his slaves, Eunice, and then, not scrupling at incest or recognizing the humanity in his slaves that would make his act incest, got that daughter, Thomasina, pregnant. Eunice's response was to kill herself. That act is personal and literal, but it is also a powerful metaphor of the horrors of slavery and the outcomes when people's capacities for self-determination is stripped away utterly. The slave woman has no say in how her body or her daughter's has been used, nor is any avenue open for her to express her outrage. The only escape permitted to her is death. Slavery allows its victims no decision-making power over any aspect of their lives, including the decision to live. The lone exception, the only power they have, is that they may choose to die. And so she does. Even then, old Carruthers McCaslin's only comment is to ask whoever heard of a black person drowning herself, clearly astonished that such a response is possible in a slave. That Eunice's suicide takes place in a novel that draws its title from a spiritual, in which Moses is asked to go down into Egypt to set my people free, is no accident. If Moses should fail to appear, it may fall to the captive race to take what actions they can to liberate themselves. Faulknerian violence quite often expresses such historical conditions at the same time that it draws on mythic or biblical parallels. Not for nothing does he call one novel Absalom Absalom, in which a rebellious, difficult son repudiates his birthright and destroys himself. Light in August, 1932, features a character named Joe Christmas, who suffers emasculation at the novel's end. While neither his behavior nor his particular wound is very obviously Christ-like, his life and death have to do with the possibility of redemption. Of course, things change when irony comes in, but that's another matter. Thus far, we've been speaking of character-on-character violence. So what about violence without agency, where writers simply dispose of their characters? Well, it depends. Accidents do happen in real life, of course. So do illnesses. But when they happen in literature, they're not really accidents. They're accidents only on the inside of the novel. On the outside, they're planned, plotted, and executed by somebody with malice aforethought. And we know who that somebody is. I can think of two novels from the 1980s that involve characters floating down to Earth after a jetliner explosion. Faye Weldon in The Hearts and Lives of Men, 1988, and Salman Rushdie in The Satanic Verses may have slightly different purposes in introducing such massive violence into their storylines and then having some characters survive. We can be fairly sure, however, that they do mean something, several somethings, by the graceful falls to Earth that their characters undergo. The little girl in Weldon's novel occupies what amounts to a state of grace in an otherwise corrupt adult world. The easy descent of the airliner's tail section proves a lovely, gentle corollary to this quality in the child. Rushdie's two characters, on the other hand, experience their descent as a fall, not from innocence to experience, but from an already corrupt life into an existence as demons. So too with illness. We'll talk later about what heart disease means in a story, or tuberculosis, or cancer, or AIDS. The question always is, what does misfortune really tell us? It's nearly impossible to generalize about the meanings of violence, except that there are generally more than one, and its range of possibilities is far larger than with something like rain or snow. Authors rarely introduce violence straightforwardly to perform only its one appointed task, so we ask questions. What does this type of misfortune represent thematically? What famous or mythic death does this one resemble? Why this sort of violence and not some other? The answers may have to do with psychological dilemmas, with spiritual crises, with historical or social or political concerns. Almost never, though, are they cut and paste, but they do exist, and if you put your mind to it, you can usually come up with some possibilities. Violence is everywhere in literature. We'd lose most of Shakespeare without it, and Homer and Ovid and Marlowe, both Christopher and Philip, much of Milton, Lawrence, Twain, Dickens, Frost, Tolkien, Fitzgerald, Hemingway, Saul Bellow, and on and on. I guess Jane Austen wouldn't be too much affected, but relying on her would leave our reading a little thin. It seems then that there's no option for us but to accept it and figure out what it means.